Greetings. This is Michael Thiemann. I'm your host of today's OpenSource.com Open Your World Forum, and I'm also honored to be the speaker in this particular slot. I'm going to be talking about transformation. It's a term that comes from a variety of different contexts, but I'm using the context that Deming talked about when he talked about bringing industry out of crisis. So I'll try and keep myself to about 35 minutes so that there can be 10 minutes of Q&A. If you have any questions, send them on to our folks who will convey them into the question box. We are providing slides for all these presentations after the forum, and also the audio is being recorded of all these sessions so you can play stuff back. We're already seeing that a lot of folks are playing back the morning sessions who didn't get up in time for when we started. So, next slide, please. It's always a mystery to me which quote I'm going to use to start off the presentation, but one of my favorite ones from Albert Einstein that I thought was particularly appropriate for this topic was the one about how we cannot solve the problems. We cannot solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. And boy, have we quite some problems in the world of information technology. Since 2006, I have been charting the amount of waste estimated in the world of IT, and since that time, the IT spending has grown to $3.4 trillion U.S. dollars per year, and of that, when one takes into account that 18% of all IT applications are abandoned before going into production, and 55% are either late, lacking, broken, or some combination of the three, I estimate that there is $1 trillion a year which is being wasted due to bad software. Now, wasting 30 cents out of every dollar spent sounds pretty extravagant, and so to build my confidence in that particular analysis, I have asked every single CIO and CTO and CEO that I have met since publishing this analysis first in 2006 and asked them, do you believe that 30 cents out of every dollar overstates or understates the amount of waste attributable to bad software in IT? And to date, with hundreds of data points, I have not had a single person say that it is an overstatement of the problem. So if we take that and if people want to chime in on the question box and say, hey, that's not true in my organization, I would love to get my first negative data point. But for all the money that's being wasted today in IT, what we're also seeing is that open source is a new approach that can radically improve not only IT itself, but also the businesses that use it. And the idea that IT can improve the business is something which I think fits into the theme that Deming first developed, which is this theme of transformation. So, next slide. So, for those of you who have not read my bio, just a very quick thing. My experience is informed by first working on the world's first native code C++ compiler, and when I began working on this project, I was told by none other than the creator of the C++ language himself, Bjarne Stroustrup, that task was impossible and impractical, and yet I did it. I founded the world's first open source company providing commercial support for GNU tools, and it was thought impossible and impractical to make money based on free software. And so those two experiences have taught me a little bit about about not paying too much attention to what people dismiss as impossible and impractical, and instead focus on, you know, what's logical, what's compelling, what can be transformative. In January of 2000, Red Hat bought my company, and I became the CTO, and spent 4 years with that responsibility, and now I am the Vice President of Open Source Affairs. I'm also the President of the Open Source Initiative, and with these two roles, I travel around the world talking about open source strategy, technology, and policy for the private and the public sector, and I get a lot of feedback from senior executives in both public and commercial worlds on either what they perceive as impossible or what they perceive as absolutely vital, and this is informing this talk. Next slide. So on the surface, IT-based systems should be exponentially improving the economics, performance, and functionality based on the fact that Moore's Law gives us 2x price performance improvement every 18 to 24 months. Disk Law gives us a 2x price performance improvement every 12 to 18 months. Fiber Law tells us that network bandwidth and connectivity should be improving, doubling every 9 to 12 months. And yet, as reported out by the UN, by a UN commission in 2003, not only is there no Moore's Law for software, but actually software is becoming more complicated, more expensive, less reliable, and almost always more difficult to configure and maintain. And so while we have the benefit, we have three-dimensional benefit of exponential economic improvements in the hardware world, somehow our software systems today trump all of that and deliver systems that cost more and do less. And in fact, when we look over the last 10 to 20 years, the cost of information technology, and especially in the most recent few years, the cost of information technology is far outpacing the growth rate of gross domestic product across a number of industrialized nations. And what that tells me is that IT is now a problem in and of itself. It is not being the solution to other problems that we so desperately need. Next slide. So in this context where we've got $1 trillion a year problem that is getting worse, that strikes me as a crisis-level problem. And what Deming taught in his book, Out of the Crisis, was a comprehensive approach to basically taking an industry from crisis to success. And he put together 14 principles, and I'm going to go through these in some detail, but those first two principles that he espoused, which was first, create a constancy of purpose, second, adopt a new philosophy and change, as Dr. David Upton presented at 9 o'clock this morning, many organizations are very reluctant to change because those who are in power, while they may not be totally satisfied with the performance of their organization, many people would prefer to be captain of a sinking ship than to not be a captain at all. And so this is a great challenge. And in fact, when Deming took his method to industrial America after World War II, there's basically not a single U.S. CEO who would hear of the idea that they had a problem or that they were in crisis that needed to be remedied. The result, of course, was that Deming went to Japan and helped build their industrial base, and in the 1970s and the 1980s, the capabilities of that manufacturing transformation basically rebalanced the power of manufacturing. Today, when we look at the software world, we have a full-on excellent revolution in hardware, and we've got this disaster in software that's preventing its benefits from coming to us. So he proposed a number of other concepts about building quality in the first place, building relationships around loyalty and trust and not on price, improving the product and service constantly and forever. And there are many, many businesses which maybe talk about how important quality is, but when you sort of look under the covers and you ask yourself the question, would these guys ever say is good enough? Far too many say that what's no good at all is actually good enough. So let's go into this in a little bit of detail. Let's go forward to the next slide. And let's look at adaptability and why adaptability is so important. As I look at the metaphors and the analogies that guide various bits of business thinking, often people talk about Darwinism. They talk about economic Darwinism. They talk about survival of the fittest. And it turns out, actually, that Darwin didn't really talk about survival of the fittest. He talked about the survival of the most adaptable. Those that are adaptable are the ones that survive. And increasingly, people are beginning to recognize that sheer strength alone, sheer size alone, just like with the dinosaurs, was not in and of itself a sustainable strategy. It is adaptability that is the long-term sustainable advantage. And in fact, in October of 2009, the Department of Defense put this on the front page of a memo that went from the CIO of the U.S. Department of Defense to basically all of the executives, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the secretaries of all the military departments, the Undersecretary of Defense. It's a pretty pretty star-studded address list. And the first two sentences of this report say, to effectively achieve its missions, the Department of Defense must develop and update its software-based capabilities faster than ever to anticipate new threats and respond to continuously changing requirements. The use of open source software, OSS, can provide advantages in this regard. I have heard it from the director of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, the folks who gave us the internet, that adaptability is itself a strategic capability. And this is something, when we look at what Dr. David Upton was talking about this morning about proprietary monolithic systems, those are not systems that one would expect to be highly adaptable. Modular, open systems that invite participation are ones that we could expect and, in fact, do see as being adaptable. Next slide, please. So when we look at systems that do have adaptability at their core, we look at the Internet. Now, the Internet in 1969, as it came into being, the whole theory of its architecture was to, or the whole purpose for its existence was to be a communications infrastructure that could survive a nuclear attack. It was designed to be a system that could adapt to outages. And in fact, when I was living in Silicon Valley when the Loma Prieta earthquake hit in 1989, the only communication system not disrupted in the first 2 days after that earthquake was the Internet, and people were able to actually use email to communicate things that could not be conveyed over fixed phone lines or the cell systems of the time. And in fact, if we think about it from a little bit of a philosophical perspective, innovation itself is not possible if the system is not adaptable. It's kind of a tautology. Now, what makes innovation, what makes it possible for innovation to be meaningful and relevant is that the new has to be able to work with the old. That's interoperability. You've got to be able to take the part of the system you want to improve and improve that part without putting the whole rest of the system at risk. That's why modularity is important. That's why monolithic systems are so problematic. The concept of really inviting participation comes from the fact that necessity is the mother of invention, and most often it is the people who are experiencing the need are the people who should be listened to and the people who should be enabled. And so that's why participation is such a great way of actually bringing innovative juices into the equation. And then finally, as Deming taught, we should treat human beings as if they are valuable. We should invest in human potential and human competence. And the more that we can bring skills and knowledge to the folks in the system, the more they can participate, the more they can innovate. And going back to the statistics of the $1 trillion number, if a system can be better adapted, there is less reason to abandon. I am increasingly trying to drill down on why are so many systems abandoned before they go into production. And one reason is because they were specified to solve a problem that no longer exists by the time the system is actually ready to go online. And lack of adaptability is one of the reasons why you get these battleship-style IT projects that cannot be turned. Now, also, when systems are adaptable, they can be more easily reused. And we have seen some fascinating reports coming out literally from the front lines of the two wars in the Gulf, where soldiers were able to take systems that were originally designed for one purpose and adapt them to an entirely different purpose. A Red Hat engineer serving in the infantry in Afghanistan, I believe, took a bunch of web cameras that are initially designed to just notice your cat walking around the living room at night and send you information about, you know, your cat's exploits around the house. Turn that into a system to identify friend or foe and help keep his unit safe. That adaptability leads to reuse, which leads to sustainability. Next slide. So when we look at the observed results in the world of open source, if we just were to compare open source to proprietary software and some measurements of quality, there's a company in California who builds a software analysis, software engineering tool, and one of the peculiar things about their particular license agreement is if you use their tool, you must submit defect data in an anonymized fashion to their central repository so that they can build a concept of what is average. So they built an average of proprietary software that found 20 to 30 defects per 1,000 source lines of code. And you might, you know, just all by itself, that number doesn't sound particularly meaningful, but, you know, if you happen to have something that's 5.7 million lines of code, like the Linux kernel, if it came out with average, typical software quality, that would mean that there would be between 114 and 171,000 defects. That's kind of a scary number. The Toyota Lexus is estimated to have 100 million lines of source code running around in it. You know, that would be a terrifying number if Toyota were not better than average on their software development. And yet, in 2004, when the Linux kernel was 5.7 million lines of code, they did not find over 100,000 defects. They found fewer than 1,000. Moreover, of the defects that were found, 100% of them were analyzed, and all of the ones deemed serious were fixed within 6 months. When they reran the test a year later, they found that the defect density had decreased, even though the code complexity and code size had increased, which is also fascinating because many of these commercial programs that have the high defect density rate that we see here, 20 to 30 per 1,000 lines of source code, they are basically unremediable. And so once a program has a certain number of problems, you basically need to give up on it. That was what Fred Brooks taught in a book called The Mythical Man Month. Next slide. Now, in 2006, people began to say, well, maybe Linus Torvalds is an outlier, and maybe the Linux kernel is a statistical outlier, a la the Malcolm Gladwell book. And so what they did is they expanded their analysis to 32 open source programs, and what they found was an average still of less than one-half a defect per 1,000 lines of code. Perl had a very good score. The GNU compiler collection, which I used to work on, also had a very good score. Python had a pretty decent score. And what they found, a couple of interesting things that they found. First of all, there's absolutely no correlation between the size of the program under test and its defect density, which meant that none of the open source projects have yet created the kind of hairball that we see in certain proprietary programs where no version ever works after a given date because it's so damn big and so full of bugs. Now, when you look at the LAMP stack, Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP, which drives most of the blogosphere and many, many of the internet portals, while our overall defect density is again pretty good, PHP was the runt of the litter. It had a whopping 0.474 defects per 1,000 lines of code, so it's only 40 times better than the average proprietary software instead of a more respectable 100-fold. Next slide. But now here's where these principles of Deming start to come in, because in 2008, this 2006 survey was interesting enough that the Department of Homeland Security, as part of its cybersecurity program, decided that they would go and scan an even wider set of open source software. So they looked at 250 open source programs that comprised 55 million lines of source code, and what they found across that very wide aperture was an incredibly low 0.33 defects per 1,000 lines of source, but the PHP project was one of 11 projects that had zero detectable defects. Now, take a step back for a second and imagine you're at a proprietary software company, and your quality manager walks in and says, hey, I've got some great news for you. We're 40 times better than the industry average. You know, are you going to get more money to become better, or are you going to be told, oh, my God, that's way too good. You know, we need to get rid of all the quality guys and start putting in more, you know, more features and probably more bugs. And yet, when PHP finds out that it's only 40 times better than average, they kick it into high gear, and it doesn't stop there. 1 year later, with an even larger sample set, the defect density goes down by double digits, and there are three times as many projects that have achieved that perfect score. Now, this fits exactly the hypothesis that Deming put forward, which is that if you give people the chance to be proud of what they do, they will amaze you with their ability to improve. And this, when you have enough people who have that freedom to participate, that ability to join in the network effect, we see exactly the kinds of things that we expect of improved quality. So when we look at this problem, this $1 trillion a year going down the drain, partly because applications are not sufficiently adaptable, and let's look at what are the principal reasons why projects would be late. What are the reasons that projects would be missing key functionality? And in particular, you know, projects having bugs that significantly impact performance, those all relate to quality. And by open source having cracked the quality problem to deliver two orders of magnitude better than average proprietary software, it's probably little wonder that virtually all of the major internet platforms and portals and other innovative technologies have got open source, not proprietary software, at the core. Next slide. So I want to sort of put this into a historical context about how important this concept of participation is. We're going to go back in time. This is a graph. It was taken from a paper put together by a grad student working on his PhD, and what we see is the efficiency of the steam engine as invented by James Watt. And to the left of that heavy vertical line are the improvements of efficiency that James Watt made to his steam engine. And we see that he improved the efficiency from about 6% to about 20% while having the exclusive permission to basically hack on the steam engine for 30 years because of a patent. Now, the patent expired in 1800, and he wanted to renew it. He needed an act of Parliament to get that patent in 1775, and he went back to Parliament and said, the whole Industrial Revolution is going to come to an end if I can't get this patent renewed. Parliament said, then it will. And so they let it expire, and interestingly enough, there were other inventors who had other ideas about how to build steam engines, how to use steam engines, how to improve steam engines, and they could not do that because of this patent. Well, once the patent expired, they got to try all these ideas, and very, very rapidly what we see is that the rate of improvement to efficiency basically shot up as they were given these freedoms. And in fact, there's another thing which I only recently learned about the two halves of this line. Looking at Wikipedia, which is one of the projects that was certainly featured in an earlier presentation today, looking at Wikipedia, I learned that there was not an industrial revolution. There were two. The first industrial revolution is the one that James Watt got to take credit for, building steel and using steam engines to do steel production and mining operations. But to the right-hand side is what Wikipedia calls the second industrial revolution, and that's what happened when there was lots and lots of innovation and application of these ideas, this effectively a collective invention, open source style model. And so James Watt was absolutely correct in his prediction that his industrial revolution, limited to a very finite world, would in fact come to an end, and thank goodness that it did, because that opened up all this other innovation. And England was a great beneficiary of the first industrial revolution. It was America and the innovations in that came out in this country, which needed a whole lot of machinery for a whole lot of reasons, that benefited from the second. Next slide. Now, a more modern interpretation of how we achieve this quality comes from a study that was done comparing the development of proprietary software and the development of open source software. In 2001, Professors James Herbslev and Andrew Mockus tried to characterize the difference in developers working in proprietary and open source projects. And what they found, this is a graph of the Apache project. And what they did is they would look at the source code repository, and for every line of source changed, every line of source added, every line of source deleted, they would attribute it to the developer who made the change, stack it all up, and then the person who did the most of everything would be called developer number one. And by this graph, we see that developer number one does about 16 to 20% of everything, which means that if software follows the industrial model, which which Fred Brooks tells us it does not, but if it did, then 5 to 6 people would all you'd need to do for Apache. Now, it turns out that in the proprietary software world, it's exactly the same. They looked at 12 proprietary projects, 12 open source projects, and all of them had that characteristic that developer number one was approximately 20% of everything. When you see what the developer, when you see it in both proprietary and open source, is that when you have 5 developers across these projects, you get about 40%, not 100%, but about 40% of everything. And when you move out to 15 developers, again, you still are at about the 80% level. Now, Harvard Business School continues to teach the 80-20 rule. And so many people, you know, once they get to that magic 80%, say, ah, it's good enough. And what we see in the world of proprietary software is that, in fact, once they've hit that 80% level with 15 people, what they tend to do is they hire enough people so that when developer number one burns out, they can send another, you know, they can move everybody up the chain. And when other people sort of wash out for other reasons, they've got sort of a replacement team. So they tend to have 20 to 30 people on their development teams as a sort of a safety margin for the 15 that they need to get to 80%. But what we see in this graph here is, and this is a very old graph because Apache only had 388 developers at the time, but developer number 388, you know, maybe gets the credit for one line of source code changed or one line added or one line deleted, and that may seem like such an insignificant thing, but the fact that developer number 388 can participate and can make that change turns out to be incredibly, incredibly important. Earlier this morning, Dr. David Upton talked about the difference between how strategic planning tries to really sort of set the goals and then let IT sort of be the tail that wags, be the tail of the dog that follows the strategy. And yet, what he observed is that actually, increasingly, as we move from a set of industrial fixed assumptions to a dynamic marketplace of ideas, it is the tail in which the value is created. And this chart of Apache shows that most of the people who are participating in Apache are way out in the tail and not in that in that head state. But the other thing which is so important, when I first encountered the slide, I was still remembering myself as developer number one of the GNU C++ compiler, where I did do 20% of everything, and a handful of people, you know, did half of everything else. And so from this slide, I focused mainly on what was happening to the left with a theoretical understanding of how useful it was that one random person could send me one random bug fix that would help me make a better release. But lately, I've been developer number 388. I occasionally make patches to the R project or to Blender or to, you know, other programs that I encounter. And what I have learned in that experience is it is so wonderful to be able to fix the problem where it is instead of having to try to figure out how to implement a workaround that can otherwise solve the problem. And what occurred to me is the network effect of being able to fix the actual problem is the most likely explanation of how open source achieves two orders of magnitude better quality than proprietary software. Because in the world of proprietary software, if you're forced to make a workaround because you don't have access to where the real bug lies, you're putting garbage into your own code to counteract the garbage that's in somebody else's. And when you've got 100 different projects all filling each other or filling themselves with garbage because of all the garbage that the other ones have, this quickly devolves into the kind of software quality and the kind of brittleness that is so characteristic of these monolithic systems. Next slide. So the result is that open source has moved well beyond the margins, and it has been identified not only, you know, as one of the most important forces that is shaping the future of the world today. Thomas Friedman declares open source to be the most disruptive of the 10 forces flattening the world today. But we see it flattening things like the top 500 supercomputers. When I left college, you know, the coolest thing in the world, except for temperature-wise, but, you know, the most amazing computer of the day was the Cray supercomputer. I mean, it was a hand-wired. You know, they measured the length of the wire to millimeters so that the wavelengths of light would all be aligned when they ran around this discrete componentry. And today, you know, laptops routinely run rings around supercomputers that sold for millions of dollars in the 1990s. Open source is now running 94% of the workload of the top 500 globally. Open source has been a catalyst to create not only Web 1.0, not only inspire the thinking of the Creative Commons, which has produced over 100 million creative works, but it has informed Wikinomics, it's informed crowdsourcing, it's moved on to Web 2.0 and Gov 2.0, and increasingly it's also a defining technology in Google's mobile application and platform strategy. Next slide. So, we've also, in addition to having all this power, we've earned a lot of trust and respect. A couple of weeks ago, people talked about a quote-unquote crash at the stock markets in the U.S., and my first response was, they didn't crash at all. They worked perfectly. I have been in Tokyo when excessive trading volume literally brought the exchange down at an operational level, not at a pricing level, but at an operational level. I have seen that happen to the London Stock Exchange before they, they had announced a move from a proprietary platform, but they had not yet effected the move. But today, the major exchanges are running record levels of transactions with basically no hiccups. What we heard just in the previous session from Dr. John Halamka from Deaconess Medical Center and the Harvard Medical School is that since moving to Red Hat Enterprise Linux 3 years ago, he has had zero operational downtime, which is, you know, a fantastic thing. It's trusted to run the White House website, which is basically, the front porch for the virtual world of America. And the National Institutes of Health, the amount of scientific information that is served through this open source portal is absolutely phenomenal. And the National Institutes of Health, in my travels around the world as a scientific research and publication organization, is really the single richest gift that we give to the world in terms of scientific data. Gartner has basically rewritten all of their predictions to comport with what we ourselves see happening, which is that basically the future of commercial software is open source, and this should not be a paradox. When I started Cygnus back in 1989 and I talked about selling commercial support for free software, people said, well, you can't have those two things in the same sentence. It's either commercial or it's free. And I said, no, it's either proprietary or it's free, but both can be commercial, and we're now seeing that today. Next slide. So, here we go. So today, where are we? We're getting that next slide? Oh, I'm sorry. So Another thing which I think is just an amazing story of the success of open source, and this gets right to the question of adaptability, is the National Security Agency's SE Linux project. The NSA has invested a tremendous amount in understanding how to build secure systems, and the frustration that the NSA had was that every time a proprietary vendor would implement their security model on a proprietary system, it would become this niche product that would ultimately have no support for any applications nor modern hardware. And the NSA said, after seeing that movie several times, they asked Red Hat, would it be possible for us to bring our technology into open source? And if so, how would we ensure that this future does not repeat itself? And our theory was that if we made an effort to make high-grade security ubiquitous and really did it the open source way, that ultimately they would get what they want and all users would get what they need. And when we initially proposed this plan, there was a lot of resistance, and especially from many people in the open source community. They said, the reason you should not do this, the reason it's a dumb idea to try, is because it's impossible. Well, I'd heard that before. Next slide. And I knew that that alone should never be a reason to reject something. SE Linux succeeded the open source way. From Fedora Core 3, where we had support for 14 initial policies, one of the most popular one, of course, being the lockdown of HTTPD, the Apache web server. We had 80-plus policies supported in Fedora Core 4. We then went to a modular user-loadable policy management infrastructure in Fedora Core 5, and now there are thousands of protected applications and services. And today, it is taken for granted that SE Linux is an available technology as a fundamental open source capability. And the benefits of this have been fantastic. RHEL 4 has been in commercial release now for 5 years, and we have had zero kernel exploits. RHEL 5 has been in commercial release for about 3 years now, and we've had zero critical kernel exploits. Now, we have had critical exploits that have been identified and fixed and patched in Firefox and in Thunderbird and other applications, but again, you know, SE Linux is about protecting the kernel, and we have been absolutely perfect in that regard across two different commercial release teams. And again, this feeds right into this Deming theory of, you know, let's make something just as good as it can be. And it's not a moment too soon. With the move to virtualization and cloud computing, I think that the fundamental security architecture and infrastructure that has now got years under its belt, is well understood and well supported across a wide range of applications, it is now safe to embrace these new technologies and to leverage those in new ways, knowing that the kernels that you're running are managing security correctly instead of multiplying your security problems. And I think it's a wonderful bit of poetic irony that, you know, breaking down barriers to participation helped build better barriers to keep the bad guys out and keep the good stuff running. Next slide. So, one of the things that I focus on a lot is, and it's at the core of this question about remedying the trillion-dollar problem, is what makes IT valuable? Now, there's a magazine called CIO Insight who has been surveying 1,000 CIOs for the last 6 years, and they have been asking the question, they've been collecting data, and what they have found, and I think this makes perfect sense, what makes IT valuable is helping companies increase revenues, decrease costs, solve the business problems they're paid to solve, and deliver a measurable ROI. What makes the vendors valuable? Delivering all that plus delivering on time and on budget, being flexible and responsive, and delivering a quality product. And then finally, you know, the sort of the Deming health check. Are you doing it right? If you had a choice, would you do business with that vendor again? If your answer to that question is yes, you pass the Deming test. If you do all that good stuff but you can't do business any with them, then you haven't really achieved that transformative new paradigm. Next slide. And so an image I want to leave you basically, the transformation process is relatively straightforward. You use open source to drive out proprietary costs. It leaves you with more money for more innovation. You improve productivity and collaboration with open source best practices. You encourage user-driven innovation that has a consequence of making more of the world your R&D lab and more of the world your customers. And you embrace this concept with open source. The transformation is everybody's job, not just everybody within the company, but everybody in the world. So I'll leave you with this little image, which I love to present. This is a resonant pendulum. It's at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, California. And you can read about it on Wikipedia, how it works. But the Gandhi quote, "Whatever you do will be insignificant, but it is very important that you do it," can be experienced by taking a very, very weak magnet and using the impulses that you apply to that magnet to move this enormous concrete cylinder. It ties right back into this concept of Kaizen, where if you can make a 0.02% improvement every single day, guess what happens when 1,000 other people do it? Every single day, you leapfrog the competition. So with that, I'd like to see if there are any questions, and if not, then I'll what will I do? You guys want to ask some questions? Well, I'll share a little math with you then. So the math is, if you do improve things by 0.02%, and you get 1,000 people doing it, that's a 22% improvement. And so this concept of being able to make these continuous improvements shows how important the network effect is. So when a single company, you know, puts their top 20 developers on some problem, the exponential math really doesn't work the way it does when you bring the whole world together. So, and as far as a question has come in, is how do we see this happening outside of IT? One of the stories in the Wall Street Journal, which I've had about half a dozen people forward to me, and I haven't read it yet, but GlaxoSmithKline, for example, has just said that they're looking to use open source methodologies for better identifying promising drug treatments. And certainly what we heard before with the Creative Commons music panel earlier today is that these concepts of sharing and letting other people improve their works, the artist known as Brad Sucks basically credits the remix community to taking his original products, songs, remixing them, making them better, making them more popular, returning the gift to him, and he now counts as his principal source of income the music that he makes, and he does that the open source way by freely inviting others to join him, participate, improve, and redistribute. So, with that, I guess we're waiting for Richard Fontana to show up. Anybody? I'll also put a plug in for a couple of other things. The Red Hat Summit is June 22nd through the 25th in Boston, and some of the folks who we heard from today will be speaking at the summit in a variety of different configurations. Dr. David Upton will be talking on a panel that I'm chairing. Dr. John Holomko will be talking with Jim Whitehurst, and we have a lot of other ways of connecting the dots with how open source best practices among Red Hat-specific customers and Red Hat-specific products can be employed. But here at opensource.com, we're more focused on the community events, and we're thrilled to have so many people participating on so many subjects today.